The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. On this show, we usually try to present a serious scientific or skeptical topic in a somewhat lighthearted way. Well, that won't be the case on today's episode. Let me start by saying that people can be wonderful. We are capable of selflessness and heroism and the kind of acts that creatively inclined people write odes to. But we also have the capacity for violence and for terror. So what brings humans to commit inhuman acts? How could an entire society rationalize genocide? How can normal people reach the point where it's possible for them to see other people as so different that in their eyes, they aren't really people at all? And is it possible that given similar situations, we would commit those same atrocities? Today we'll be speaking about the psychological, neurological, and societal aspects of cruelty with author and researcher Kathleen Taylor. And as this is a pre-produced episode of Skeptically Speaking, there will be no audience questions. So before we get to the depressing bit, here's some speaking up. We're here with Marc-Julien Aubjois, software developer and photographer, who's helping to organize Edmonton's very first Skepticamp. Welcome, sir.
Hi, Desiree.
So our listeners will probably know from previous episodes, a Skepticamp is when a bunch of people get together to do a day's worth of short presentations about skeptical topics, correct?
That's right. We're trying to get about 150 people to come to the U of A, and you can talk about pretty much whatever you want. We already have a few people lined up. Mark McKenzie, who was on the show previously, is going to be on, and he's going to talk about radiation and health, cell phone radiation, power lines, stuff like that. And he was a big hit on the show, and I think he'll be a big hit in person, too.
I know I did receive emails from quite a few people in Edmonton who were wondering where they could hear Mark McKenzie speak. So this is your chance. You know who you are. So what kind of subjects can we look forward to?
Well, there's a lot of things that the skeptical community finds interesting. I'm hoping to hear people talk about psychics, magic, alternative health, paranormal type stuff, climate change, which is a hot button topic.
Absolutely.
I would like to hear people talking about evidence-based journalism as well, talking about climate change. Cryptozoology is one of those, you know, really wacky ones that I think would be great to talk about. We'd like to get as many experts, physicists, professors, you know who you are. It doesn't matter what your background is, as long as you have an expertise, an area of expertise, and you're willing to come and talk. You show up on the 24th at 10 in the morning at the U of A, and you get to put your name up on a board and tell us when you want to talk, and people will listen to you for 20 minutes and then possibly ask you questions. That's a part of the format. There's a QA after each presentation.
So for anybody that feels like maybe their field is misunderstood, perhaps.
That's exactly right. If people get what you do wrong on a regular basis, this is exactly where you want to be. It's an opportunity for you to talk about your field to a variety of people. And, you know, even if you're a professor at the U of A, you talk about this stuff all the time, but you get to talk to people who aren't enrolled in your class, who aren't going to university. And it should be interesting and eye-opening to everybody.
And actually, those people might be more interested than the people that you're teaching in your class.
That's right. They might not be as ungrateful.
So, Marc-Julien, what's your ideal presentation? What would you like to see?
Well, I'm interested in way too many things. But right now, I've actually just started watching The Mentalist. And I've read a book on cold reading before and thought it was fascinating. And I would love to have someone come in and talk about how a psychic does what they do. there's a way of asking someone a question in such a way that no matter what the answer is, they think you already knew the answer. And those tricks of the trade, I think, are fascinating, and I'm sure we have the expertise. If you know how to do this, if you're an expert, if you've done it for money, please come and talk and educate us.
And so just to clarify, people don't actually have to give a presentation to come and watch these.
Oh, that's right. There's no commitment. You come, you listen to interesting people talk about interesting things, and you get free food.
You can say free food again.
Free food.
So when and where?
It's at the U of A. The exact room is not currently known, but it'll be announced closer to the date. It's happening on July 24th. 10 o'clock is when you need to show up if you are presenting, and 11 o'clock is when the presentations actually begin. We're taking a break for lunch around 1 and going till 3 o'clock, I believe.
And you do want people to head to the website as well?
Yes. In fact, whether you're presenting or not, you should go to the website and register. If you go to edmontonskeptics.com, you'll see a link to the Skepticamp page. And in the top right corner of the Skepticamp page, there's a register button. So please sign up. And if you do want to present, there is a box for generic info about yourself. Put what you want to talk about in that box, and we'll get back to you if there's anything else you need to know. And it'll give other people a good idea of what they're going to get to hear.
Perfect. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, me too.
Thanks for being here, Mark Julian.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
We're joined today by Kathleen Taylor, a science writer living in Warwickshire, UK. She did her first degree in physiology and philosophy, her second in neuropharmacology, and her doctorate in computational neuroscience. She then did her postdoctoral work in cognitive neuroscience, which was definitely the long way to decide to become a nonfiction writer. She's the author of the book Cruelty: Human Evil and the Human Brain. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to start by saying you need a warning label on your book. Do not read in one sitting, because that is too much horror for one day.
Yes, I think it should have a health warning. in fact, actually, if you look at it, there are warnings in the book. It's a very depressing topic. All I can say is if you think reading it's bad, you should try writing it.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
It's awful, believe me. I'm glad I've done it.
Well, in between the very enjoyable neuroscience and psychology and cultural analysis, there are many, many stories of extreme cruelty. And I definitely had a visceral reaction to some of them. So why did you choose such graphic illustrations?
Well, there were various reasons. One of the main ones, I guess, was that I wanted to remind people that this is about real stuff. It's very easy when you're talking about, for example, the science of how the brain works to get caught up in the abstractions and think of neurons doing this and that and the other. And it all seems very abstract. And also when you're looking at social psychology, you can talk about experiments and groups and people doing, and it all seems very abstract. I wanted to remind people that actually this has a very important real world application. This stuff really happens. It's horrible, but it's actually real. So just talking about it in the calm, quiet, dispassionate language of science is all very well. And you've got to do that in a way to get into it. But you've also got to keep in mind that this has real application, that this stuff is life and death and it matters. So by bringing in the extreme examples, I wanted to say, look, you know, this is not just abstract. This really matters. This is important stuff because this is what consequences are if you don't actually try and understand cruelty. then you're going to repeat it and you're going to get more of this and more of these terrible examples.
Well, I was also thinking that maybe you had written it in that way because the very concept of what cruelty is isn't necessarily common. But I think we can all agree that the examples you used were indeed cruel.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, cruelty is very much clearly illustrated by the extreme examples. But one of the arguments of the book is that actually, you know, there is a lot of cruelty that is less extreme, but it is nonetheless cruel. So by illustrating the examples, I wanted to have examples that everybody could agree on, because there's a lot of debate over what is cruel and what isn't. And part of the theme, if you like, of the book is that what one person thinks is perfectly reasonable behavior, another person may see as cruel. So there's a lot of debate over what is cruelty, especially when passions run high, when it's your soldiers or your paramilitaries that are involved. So because cruelty is so debatable, I wanted to have very clear extreme examples that most people would agree were undoubtedly cruel.
So how do you define cruelty?
I have a sort of working definition in the book, which is centered around, if you like, three concepts. In a sense, you can split cruelty into a kind of scientifically analyzable component, the behavior. You can quantify it, you can say how much, etc. And then there's a moral component, which is the sort of social side of it, which is whether it's right or wrong, basically. So you have that kind of division between the sort of analyzable behavior and the moral component. That's the first thing. So the first component of that is this intentional behavior. It's not done by accident. It's not done by somebody who's deranged. It's done by somebody who's intending to do what they're doing. And that person is a perpetrator or perpetrators. So that's the first axis, if you like, of cruelty. The second, obviously, and I think the most important axis, is the axis of the victim, the person who suffers, the person who experiences not only necessarily pain, but anguish and humiliation. So there's a strong psychological component there. So that's the second axis. And the third axis, which is, if you like, where the moral judgment comes in, because cruelty is all about morality and moral condemnation and judgment. And that is the observer, the perpetrator's watcher, the judge, if you like. So you've got the perpetrator who does the behavior, the victim who suffers it, and some society, history, God, the conscience, whatever it is, some role that is doing the observing and making the moral judgment. And that's the third axis. So you always have these three components to cruelty.
So you say your book sets out to provide preliminary groundwork for the development of a scientific theory about cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, neuroscience I can understand, and psychology, of course, but some people consider morality subjective. So can science actually tell us about morals?
Yes, I think it can. In fact, it's one of the very hottest areas of recent neuroscience at the moment, is neuroscience and psychology of morality. There's a lot of evidence now that although morality may appear entirely subjective, it's not. It's constrained. And it's constrained by what seem to be pretty universal patterns all the way across. So if you look in different cultures, for example, different nations or races, what you find is that although the specific content of the moral rule may vary up to a point, so for example, some people think that kissing in public is disgusting and an abomination, whereas other people think it's fine. So the specific content varies from culture to culture, but the pattern of behaviors, the idea that some things are abominations and some things aren't, some things are permissible and some things aren't, the difference between moral rules, which you do not break because they are wrong, versus conventional rules, which you do not break because it's easier to follow them. All these sort of structural differences seem to be the same in every culture that people have looked at. And so what that tells you is that morality may be a little bit more like language. The specific languages differ from culture to culture, but the way languages are built up and structured seems to be much the same. And the same has been suggested to be true of morality. Now, whether or not you go as far as that, it does seem that morality is constrained by a whole lot of things that we wouldn't expect it to be constrained by if it were purely subjective. So, for example, the emotions you're feeling at the time, the context that you find yourself in, all of these, they actually change your moral behavior and your moral judgment.
So would you say that we need that discussion of morality and a discussion of science at the same time to really understand cruelty? We need interdisciplinary research.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's crucially important. I think you have to have some give on both sides. You have to have an acceptance from the scientists that this is something that raises extremely strong passions, that morality is very much key to how people see themselves, and that there is a social cultural dimension to it. Okay, so there is that extra moral component. On the other side, you have to have some kind of acceptance that morality is not just a dictate that cannot be changed. It's not just a tradition or a divine command or whatever you happen to be, that there are patterns, if you like, in morality that can be understood scientifically. I think you absolutely have to have both. So you have to have some kind of tolerance on both sides. But you also need to do this because understanding cruelty, trying to understand what produces it, what makes it worse, that's absolutely essential to try and stop it, which, of course, is the ultimate goal of all of this. I mean, the reason for writing the book is to say, look, we have this information. We understand a good deal already. We know what we can do to stop cruelty. So we have to take those steps to understand more, to try and reduce the amounts of cruelty that there are. You know, we've had moral judgments about cruelty ever since the year dot. We still have cruelty. So moral judgment by itself doesn't actually stop it.
Well, you say that cruelty is a response to threats.
Largely, yes.
What kind of threats?
Well, I think they vary. And that's because, I mean, obviously the types of cruelty that you get vary. The thing about cruelty is that it's gratuitous. There's something excessive about it. It's going further than you need to go to achieve your goals. So it's that sort of level of extra unpleasantness, if you like, that makes cruelty distinguishable from, for example, just aggression, okay, or self-defense or something like that. So cruelty is a threat response, but it's one that's, if you like, overactive. It's just hyper-response. The response varies depending on what the threat is. The threat can be, for example, a threat to your existence. So you may be afraid that you or your culture or your people are going to be absolutely wiped out, in which case you're going to respond with a huge amount of fear and you're going to lash out very violently and aggressively. And perhaps because we're not that good at calibrating our responses, you're going to go too far and other people are going to turn around and say, "Ooh, that was cruel." So that's one type of response. But there are other responses to other kinds of threats. So, for example, something might make you really angry and you might say something really nasty because you've just been irritated. So depending on what emotions you're considering or you're stirring up, you can actually start breaking cruelty down into these different components. So instead of just thinking of it as, oh, yuck, that's evil, take it apart and start to understand that different threats, different emotional responses may produce different kinds of cruelties. And that's crucial because if you're trying to prevent the kind of cruelty that is based on fear, you're going to have to do it in a very different way than if you're trying to prevent the kind of cruelty that's based on disgust.
You talk about learned threats.
Symbolic threats. If you think of us as evolved creatures, if you think of us as having developed programmed responses to common situations, for example, most people don't have the kind of threat response to a gun that they would to a fast-moving, large, black, hairy spider. Now, I speak as someone who is not keen on spiders, but even people who don't mind them, if they see something scuttle across the edge of their, they'll get a startle response. They'll react. That's a threat response. What's happening is that your body is gearing up to do something, to flee or to squash the critter or whatever it happens to be. But your adrenaline's starting to flow. You're getting a threat response. So you have these different responses to things, but ancient threats, threats that you are, if you like, programmed to respond to, are going to be much more, you know, automatic, much more responsive than modern threats, even though, actually, a big, fat, hairy spider is probably not going to do you very much harm because it wants to get out of your way, whereas a gun quite likely could do a lot of harm. So our threat responses, if you like, are not well coordinated with how the world actually is, but they're quite well coordinated with how it was. So much for evolutionary psychology. I mean, that's fine as far as it goes, but we've made things a lot more complicated because we have symbolic thinking, and what that allows us to do is to tie in emotional responses and associate them with threats which by themselves are not a problem. Ideas, for example, books, you know, behaviors. A book lying on the shelf is not going to do anybody any harm by itself. It can't. It's an inanimate object. But what that book contains may be seen as so perilous and so dangerous and so challenging that the book must be burnt and the people who carry it must be sometimes burnt as well. So ideas, although in themselves they're completely powerless, they can actually come to be associated with deadly threats And that's because of the power of symbolic thinking that can link abstract notions in with very, very strong emotions.
So how do humans deal with those threats then? And do they deal with them differently, the very immediate threats versus the symbolic threats?
Well, in general, if you've got an extreme threat to your life, you're going to react automatically with a fear response. People talk about acting so fast that they didn't think what they were doing. They react very quickly. So that's a very strong threat. Now, if you're working on a symbolic threat, the initial reaction is to sort of shrug and say, whatever, there is no problem. Because, a book's, as I said, it's not going to do you any harm by itself. However, in certain situations, and particularly when you've got someone who is propagandizing, who will benefit politically from whipping up a sense of threat, Adolf Hitler being the obvious example. Mm-hmm. But when you've got that sort of situation, it's amazing how in a group context, people can actually start to take threats seriously because their leaders tell them that they are to be taken seriously. And if you add into that that there is typically a long history between, say, two opponents in a civil war, that sort of thing, then you can start meshing reality, i.e. the history, with fantasy, i.e. the group's plans to wipe you out, the enemy's about to attack, whatever it happens to be. And you can build up a threat that isn't there. And once people start being convinced that there is a threat, i.e. when they see their neighbors believing it and when they hear their leaders telling them that, it's amazing how strong that response can then become. So what I'm saying is it's not necessarily immediate, but you can build up to something that is very, very strong, and especially if you're then in a situation of war where, as well as the symbolic abstract threat, you have a whole lot of actual deadly threats surrounding you. So by whipping that situation up, I call it this process otherization, this gradual pushing apart of groups and escalation of hostilities. And as that goes on, the threat becomes more and more real. So although it may not feel, to begin with, as powerful as a direct ancient threat, then nonetheless, as it goes on, it becomes more and more powerful, and certainly powerful enough to govern behavior.
It's far easier to understand that immediate violent response mm-hmm. to the immediate threats, but the symbolic threats, do they more easily lead to cruelty?
They do, and the reason I think, or at least one of the reasons, is that for symbolic threats, what you're trying to do, if you're the leader of the group and you want to, for example, start a war because you think you're going to benefit from it, you're looking after a target. So, for example, in the 1930s, the Nazis targeted the Jews because they needed a scapegoat. They needed someone to blame for all the problems that Germany had. And rather than turn around and say, well, actually, it was down to us because we adopted a ludicrous strategy and then we lost the First World War. Rather than blame themselves, they looked to blame somebody else and they picked on the Jews for various historical reasons, which have been well rehearsed. Now, in that situation, the Jews are a tiny, harmless, assimilated, they're doing a lot of good, they're helping out, they're enriching the culture of the German people. So you have to make something that looks very powerless seem very powerful and dangerous so that it can be a credible threat. So how do you do that? Well, one way, which they used, was to say, aha, these people may look like a tiny harmless minority, but actually they're secretly working with our enemies, the Bolsheviks in Russia. So actually, although they look harmless, they're part of a deadly conspiracy to wipe us out. So that's one way. You link the minority to an external enemy. And you see this over and over again in mass killings. The minority, the targeted people, are accused of working with the enemy. So that's one way of doing it. And another way of doing it is to make that person or group of people into a symbolic threat. If you're doing that, the best way to do it is to use the emotion of disgust rather than fear or anger, although you can use those as well. But the reason why disgust is particularly good for this particular purpose is that it's targeted, it's associated, evolutionarily speaking, with things that won't actually do you any harm. Think about what we find disgusting. We find insects, crawly things, rotten meat, filth, excreta, that sort of thing. None of those can really do you a huge amount of harm unless you get too close to them.
Right.
So disgust is a kind of warning off signal, and what it says is, this is not going to do you any harm, or at least it looks as if it isn't, but if you get too close to it, you are going to suffer. You may even die in a while later. So it's very good for things that don't look as if they're threatening, but actually are deadly dangerous. Now, if you're trying to whip up a civil war, for example, or you're trying to target what looks like a harmless minority, that's what you need. You need the language of disgust. You need to make these people seem threatening, even though they don't look threatening at all. So what do? You call them cancers, cockroaches, typhoid, bacilli, plagues. You know, you use that kind of language. And if you look at every genocide, every mass atrocity, you will see that language coming out. The justification becomes, these people may not look dangerous, but they are. Because if you leave them alone and don't do something about them now, they will corrupt you. They will destroy you from within. They will decay. They are disgusting. And you see that language over and over again. And that's why.
So what kind of responses can humans have when they're confronted with that level of disgust?
Well, they begin with a desire to avoid whatever it is and to segregate it. I mean, for example, if you were to be unlucky enough to go home and go into your kitchen and find, say, a dog had been sick on the floor, something like that, something revolting, your first instinct is to look away and avert, you know, wrinkle your nose, classic disgust response. Your second instinct is to get rid of the whatever it is. But to do that, you want a barrier between you and it. So you might get a plastic bag or you might get gloves, whatever. You want to pick it up without actually touching it. Okay, so then you want to get rid of it, and then your instinct is to clean and erase all sign that it was ever there. Okay, so if you think of those, the first one is avoidance. Well, that's not going to work if the thing's just still sitting on your kitchen floor. So you need to do something about it, removal. And what do you do when you remove it? You take it out, you destroy it, and then you clean up afterwards. Okay, so you're avoiding it, and then you're removing it, and then you're getting rid of it. So that's basically what people do. They start by trying to avoid things. Then they want to kind of segregate everything, get it, kind of put a barrier around it. And when that's with people, you get concentration camps, ghettos, things like that. The sources, if you like, of psychological contamination are all kept together and out of normal society. So the barrier is put around them. If that does not, quote-unquote, remove the source of disgust, you then are looking at the extreme examples, getting rid of the thing, expulsion. So, for example, again, in the Second World War, an awful lot of unwanted citizens were ethnically cleansed. They were sent elsewhere. They were removed, expelled. If that doesn't work, and, I mean, the Nazis, for example, considered sending Jews to Madagascar, for goodness sake. I mean, they had all sorts of plans of trying to expel them, but they weren't feasible for various reasons. And so if you can't avoid it and you can't remove it, you then look at destruction, and we know that's happened.
But how can you go from wanting to remove yourself from the situation to effectively exterminating a people? Now, that's part of the otherization process.
I mean, what I would like to say is you can't. It's really hard. Only a few people do that. But, I mean, that wouldn't be true. Unfortunately, the whole of history tells us that actually it's remarkably easy. It takes a while, but it's remarkably easy to go from this is a problem that I want out of my life to this is a problem I'm going to have to do something about, to this is what my leader is telling me to do about it, to doing it. It's very, very easy, although it only happens in certain circumstances. So I'm not saying that people are going to do this at a drop of a hat, but we all of us do minor cruelty. So it's, none of us is a complete innocent when it comes to being cruel. We've all been cruel at some time, so we know what it's like. Escalating that, we all think we would never do it. But you've got to look at the statistics. You've got to look at the figures. Most people put in that situation go along with it. They may not like it, and most of them don't. They hate it. But nonetheless, they go along with it. And if they do it often enough, they get hardened to it. And some of them, a few, even come to enjoy it. So although it seems impossible, the problem is that we tend to underestimate the power of these old responses. Think of the symbolic threat. It's kind of hijacking primitive, if you like, responses. We have these programmed behaviors. Just for, like, for example, if you get into a brawl in a pub, you'll suddenly find yourself fighting in a way you wouldn't have thought possible. That's an old response evolved to protect you a long time ago, and that is being hijacked and brought into being. Now, we may think we're completely civilized and we have our ancient selves under control, but that's not the case, not always, especially under conditions of severe threat.
So what happens when your own individual beliefs come into conflict with what you're being told by the group?
Well, that depends on how strong your individual beliefs are and also how much your group means to you. If your group doesn't mean very much to you, then you'll hang on to your beliefs and never mind the group. If, however, your group is a matter of life and death to you, if you're relying on them for your survival, then you're liable to change your beliefs to conflict. So, I mean, there's not much evidence to date that people having been given moral teachings, if you like, having grown up as members of a religion or having grown up with sort of strong humanist convictions, there's not much evidence that they are any less likely to be horrendously, extremely cruel than anyone else. The only exception is when the moral belief in not doing harm to other people is actually part of your identity. So you think of yourself not as a priest or a journalist or a soldier or whatever it happens to be, but you think of yourself as essentially the kind of person who does not do that sort of thing. Most people don't think of themselves like that. They think of morality as a kind of, oh yeah, something I was taught in church or as a kid or whatever. But if you have it as part of your identity that you don't do it, you're more likely to stand up and resist. But not all of us have that kind of extreme pacifism as part of our identity.
So where does empathy come into play here? It seems like just the empathy switch is at some point turned off.
Yes, I mean, that certainly seems to be the impression. I mean, there's preliminary evidence from, for example, functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, that we actually do have something like a kind of empathy dimmer switch that we can modulate up or down. Empathy, however, is a little bit of a double-edged sword, because if you empathize with someone and you see someone in distress, then obviously that will stimulate helping behavior and you'll want to look after that person. But if you empathize with them too much, you can start to feel so distressed yourself that instead of wanting to help the person, you just want to push the painful stimulus away and just blank it out. So empathy is fine, but too much empathy can actually drive you, if you like, to be more cruel, because you're wanting to get rid of the painful stimulus because it's so distressing. So empathy, yes, it's the opposite, if you like, of otherization, and it's a good way to stop that sort of cycle of escalating violence by getting people to empathize. But you have to be careful in how you do that, because if you push it too far, they may actually just react worse, if you like.
So is empathy reliant on seeing people as somewhat like yourself? And that's why,
yes,
otherization is so effective?
Yes. I mean, that seems to be what people think. Certainly, if you look at the science and the networks, if you like, that seem to, quote-unquote, light up when you're looking at imaging of people who are empathizing, they have much in common with the networks that light up when people are thinking about themselves. So, I mean, putting it very crudely, it seems that what we're doing is judging people as more or less like us, more or less similar, and that we can then, by focusing on different aspects of the other person, for example, you can then modulate that and make people feel less similar. So this is where things like stereotyping and verbal abuse, all that sort of thing, all those steps, if you like, on the path to otherization, they all change the amount of similarity. So, for example, if you're invoking stereotypes, you're seeing people as simpler. And obviously, if they're simpler, because they're just a caricature, just a stereotype, rather than a fully rounded person, well, you know, you're a fully rounded person because you have experience of your own inner life. So, therefore, a stereotype is less like you. So that's one way of distancing yourself, putting a psychological barrier, if you like, between yourself and the other person.
But if we see animals hurting, for example, we seem to empathize with them.
Yes, and sometimes more than with people.
Humans are odd. We'll be right back with more on cruelty right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by explorer and wildlife photographer Mark W. Moffat to discuss his new book, Adventures Among Ants. We'll journey around the world to learn about these fascinating insects and discover the parallels between their societies and our own. And on Speaking Up, blogger Mark McCarron shares his thoughts on how to make skepticism a family affair. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night, 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to this pre-recorded episode of Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here with science writer Kathleen Taylor, and we've been discussing cruelty. So let's for a moment say your group has been effective in otherizing another group. There's a difference between not speaking up about other people's actions and following along despite your reservations. There's a difference between that and becoming actively engaged in cruelty towards another group. Is there a difference?
Yes, there is. But being silent, going along with it, is not morally neutral, because effectively that is taken as agreement. So what you're saying by doing nothing is effectively, yeah, this behavior is fine with me. I'm okay with that. It's one of the things about groups that silence is often taken to mean consent to whatever direction the group is being driven in. And often you can have just one or a very few people who are driving that group. But because everyone else is quiet and doesn't say anything, that gives anybody who might want to speak up the false impression that everyone but them agrees with what is going on. And it's much easier to stand up and say something when somebody objects than when nobody objects. Well, say you've got 100 people in your group. You've got 97 of them who are feeling a bit uncomfortable but don't really want to say anything because they don't like it, but they kind of think it's necessary and they don't know what else to do. And then you've got two people who are driving it in the direction, and you've got one person who wants to object. Well, if they object, then chances are a lot of the 97 are going to join in. But if they don't object, then everybody's going to think, well, everybody kind of, they're so I better just shut up. So it's not at all morally neutral. But it takes a lot of courage to stand up and say things, especially when you think that all 97 are against you, plus the two leaders. Whereas, in fact, it may just be the two leaders who are really, really strongly in favor of a course of action. That applies for any course of action, not just cruelty.
So you mentioned the Nazis a lot in this book, and the idea that although we consider the Nazis sadistic, they didn't see themselves that way. They wouldn't view themselves as gratuitously cruel. So can you explain that?
Well, I should say that, you know, I was brought up in Britain, and in Britain, the Nazis are the defining evil. I mean, they're the example of evil that everyone uses. So that's why there's so much of them in the book, because they are the kind of archetype. With respect to their views on sadism, if you actually look at the literature, you get Nazi leaders, people like Heinrich Himmler, saying sadism is disgusting, okay? And if I catch any of you lot being sadistic, you're out, okay? I'm going to deal with you very severely. See, that's actually part of it. He calls it unmanly, unworthy, sickening. So the morality of the Nazis actually has the same categories of evil and sadistic and beyond the pale and morally condemnable as we do. It's just that they include in their normal behavior stuff that we would think was sadistic. But they're not acting as they see it for sadistic reasons. They're acting for what they say are reasons of self-defense. Why? Because they are under a deadly threat, which, if they don't do something about it, is going to wipe them out and corrupt them and destroy the German folk and all the rest of it. Now, I mean, you know, that's rubbish. I mean, it's a rubbish argument, but that's the argument that they make. And that's a very similar argument to anyone that any of us would make if we were in the similar situations. And therein lies the peril, because those arguments seem very convincing. They convinced a lot of people. You know, when you look at the diaries and the letters that people in the S, for example, wrote, you know, they write as if they believe they are under a deadly threat. Well, the threat was largely made up, but nonetheless, they believed it. So, you know, they don't think of themselves as being gratuitous. They think of themselves as doing necessary dirty work.
And they still had a concept of morality and of decency. It just did not extend to outside their group.
Yes, they still have a concept of what is good behavior and what is worthy behavior. You know, that extended to the German people, obviously, and slightly towards people like English people, you know, prisoners of war, that sort of thing. But they had excluded certain groups from that, and the extent to which that was successful differed from person to person. I mean, some perpetrators found it very difficult even to deal with the Jews as if they weren't actually human when they actually confronted them. Other people who were far distant from it had no problem, just, you know, the Jews are animals, whatever. So otherization is something you have to work at. You escalate into this more and more extreme behavior, but it takes effort, it takes work. So there was always this kind of dynamic, changing view. And you get this, for example, in SS men who have executed a whole lot of people, and then one little child or something will move them completely, and they will just be reduced because they suddenly are empathizing, and suddenly they're seeing this child as a human being instead of as a, you know, an enemy, a target. And so you get these sudden switches. It's very dynamic. It's very flexible. You know, we change hugely dependent on the context. We're very flexible. So it's often portrayed as if it's just, okay, X group otherizes Y group and sees Y group as subhuman and therefore does behavior Z.
Right.
Well, you know, it's not like that. It's much more complicated and subtle and flexible than that.
Well, it didn't just go from Jews are fine and dandy to let's put them all in concentration camps. This is a process.
It's a long, drawn-out process, and it's got a long history behind it because, you know, there's a long cultural history in Europe, for example, of seeing certain groups as, well, not fine and dandy to begin with. So Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, that sort of thing. Mm. Those groups have a stigma before you start, and so they tend to be the ones that are picked on to be cultural targets, if you like, because they already have that negative stigma to begin with. But again, that changes over time, over culture. It's all rather flexible.
You mentioned how about how activating part of a neural pattern increases the likelihood of activating all of it. How does that relate?
Well, that relates to cruelty when you come to look at extreme cruelty. On the premise of modern neuroscience, which is that every thought, idea, concept, behavior pattern, whatever, all of that is actually instantiated in some way, represented by the activity of clusters, groups, clumps, call them what you will, of neurons. And that those dynamic patterns of activity, which are constantly changing, those actually instantiate, if you like, and govern our behavior. So you've got this idea of patterns, and then you have ideas of a pattern being a group of neurons that's active at a particular time. Some or all of that group might be active. So you can trigger part of that, and then generally it will tend to flow through the whole. So you have this idea of partial activation, complete activation, and then on top of that, you have the idea that similar things have similar patterns. Okay, so in the visual cortex, for example, you might see activation in very similar areas. If you're showing a square and a diamond in the same area of the visual field, you're going to get similar patterns coming in and similar patterns in the brain reflecting that. And what that means is that those patterns will overlap. They'll use some of the same neurons. So if you imagine thinking about a particular behavior versus actually doing the behavior, you're going to use overlapping networks there. You're going to use many of the same neurons are going to light up or be active or whatever you want to call it when you're imagining the behavior as when you're actually doing this. And there have been numerous studies using fMRI showing that some of the same areas light up when you're imagining a movement or imagining a picture as when you're actually looking at it. It's not altogether the same, but they're similar. They're overlapping. And so what that tells you is that when you're thinking about doing something but not actually doing it, you're actually using those networks and reinforcing those patterns, because remember, every time you think about something, you're sending energy, if you like, through that network, and that is slightly strengthening that network, which means that it's much more likely to spring to mind next time. So you're reinforcing, building up the strengths of these networks over and over again every time you think about something. Now, obviously, you reinforce it much more when you actually do it and get rewarded. If you do it and get punished, then obviously you damp things down and you're less likely to choose that particular behavior in the future. But if you're rewarded by actually doing it, or if you're rewarded by just thinking about it, or if you talk about it with your friends and they reward you, they show approval and everything, that's going to be strengthening that and making it that little bit more likely that when it comes to the behavior, because you've, if you like, modeled that behavior to yourself, you've thought about it and imagined what it would be like, that possibility becomes part of your possibilities, your conceptual space. And it's something you're a little bit more likely to actually do than if you'd never thought about it until you're actually confronted with the choice, do I do this or not?
I really hate to bring this up because I know my audience, but how does this relate to video games then?
Oh, the long-running controversy about whether video games are bad for you morally or not. I must admit, this is probably something I shouldn't say, but, you know, there's so much real, live, actual horror and cruelty. I know, I've just spent 4 years writing about it. There's so much of that that's actually in the world. I find it hard to get worked up about whether people are playing Grand Theft Auto or not, to be honest. I think it's a fairly minor problem. We have got lots of other ways of socializing people into accepting violence. So I think if you play video games obsessively and you get rewarded for killing people in those games, then yes, it's probably not a good idea. There's some evidence that it's going to make you a little more aggressive and perhaps predispose you a little bit towards violence. But it's not going to have half the effect of sticking you in a group of people around you who are keen on violence or watching violent movies or hearing violence reported in the news. I mean, we have loads of opportunities to model violence in society because we talk about it all the time. We see it in our films, we see it on the television, we see it in the newspapers, we hear people talk about it, we read about it in books and novels. I mean, it's part of all our conceptual space. So I think the idea that video games, well, yeah, sure, they may contribute a little, but, I mean, there are lots of other contributions to this and a lot of evidence that people will still go and do this in the circumstances. So I would concentrate on changing the circumstances rather than worrying about the video games, to be honest. That's probably a really unfashionable thing to say. I'm sorry.
No, I would say that you've made several members of my audience very, very happy.
Oh, good.
So do you think that there's a danger to trying to rationalize the kinds of behaviors that we see in genocides in the Holocaust?
I think there's more danger to not trying to do it, because if you rationalize things, the risk you run is downplaying the emotions. Well, to be honest, I would have thought for most people that's not a realistic risk, because the things that you're talking about here are so horrific and so horrible, it's impossible not, I don't think, to feel your heart bleed for the victims. You read some of these stories and you grieve, you know? You've read my book, you know. You really, really feel what is done to these people. So I think it's very important. I mean, it's very important not to lose sight of the victim. And that's why the stories are there as well. It's to get away from the 2 million dead, 1 million dead, the numbers that are meaningless. This is real people. Every one of those 1 million was a real person with a family and a life and hopes and dreams, okay? So that's another reason why those stories are in there. So as long as you bear that in mind, as long as you don't just think, oh, numbers, 1 million, 2 million, whatever, and actually remember that those are real people, I think we're so far tilted over towards emotion that a little more rationalization is necessary. So although there may be a danger in over-rationalizing, I think actually there's more danger in under-rationalizing. And the reason for that is that we've been emotive about this for years, you know. Cruelty provokes a very strong moral response in people. That moral response is immensely powerful, but it doesn't actually really help, because it evolved, I believe, being a kind of okay with this, the scientific consensus, and that consensus suggests that morality evolved in a situation where the group had a lot more power over individuals than it generally does now. So now, you know, if you disapprove of something and you think somebody's cruel, well, what's going to happen? Not a great deal. We all abhor the Holocaust, but the Holocaust still happened. We all said never again after the Holocaust, and we still have genocides. So, I mean, that moral response doesn't achieve a great deal. We still have cruelty. I think, on the contrary, if you actually try and rationalize, try and understand what causes these events, what makes these things be permissible, what makes them be allowed to happen, if you can start understanding those circumstances and working on the causes, then you have some chance of actually doing something to reduce cruelty. And that, I think, is really important, because you can moralize till the cows come home, but you still get horror, you still get genocide, you still get ethnic cleansing, you still get all the minor forms of cruelty, domestic violence, child abuse, that sort of thing. Still plenty of it.
Let's extend this. Neither of us are in the United States, so we can talk about American politics. The Tea Party people. Now, from what I see in the media, they seem to be very much engaged in the othering that you write about. Would you agree with that?
You see that a lot in American politics. It's been very instructive for me writing this book around the time that I did. I started it not that long after 9/11, and by the time I started it, the otherizing response was well in train with respect to the war on terror, the demonized enemy of Al-Qaeda, all that sort of thing was well set up by then. But with respect to otherizing your opponent within American politics, I mean, that's been going on for a long time. It seemed, I thought, to get particularly vindictive and vicious under George W. Bush, but, I mean, it doesn't show any signs of letting up now.
Now, I just realized I should probably clarify. For those listening, I'm not saying that the Tea Partiers are Nazis in the making, but I am wondering if we should be worried about them.
Yes, I would second that, just because one of the key themes of my book is that otherization is something we can all do. Most people put in that circumstance will go through that process and become more and more otherized. So the Nazis are the extreme example of that, but there are many other examples of less extreme otherization, or indeed equivalently extreme otherization. You don't have to get a murder or a genocide at the end of it. You can still get extremely distancing behavior. And so that kind of otherization is a normal human process. It's only when it becomes the extreme that you get these horrific events as the outcome. But all of us otherize to some extent. We don't have the cognitive resource to keep everyone in mind as a fully rounded human being. We have to simplify. To that extent, we always otherize. But then there's the kind of development of active hostility, and that is going a step beyond just simple kind of simplification. And certainly I think in this politics that you're talking about, you do get evidence of extreme hostility. I do think they should be worried about it, because it's a very childish way of doing politics for a start. And also it tends to solidify positions and make negotiation harder. And in practice, I think most politics is achieved by some kind of progress through compromise. And if you've got very fixed, polarized positions, that compromise becomes much harder to achieve, and therefore progress and advancement becomes that much harder to get.
So do you think that everyone, you know, in the right conditions and with the right stimuli, has the propensity for extreme cruelty?
I think that everyone has the propensity to be cruel. I think that most people, this is always about statistics and probabilities, never certainty. There's no certainty here. So not everyone, but most people put in that situation would be capable of extreme cruelty. Now, they might not object to be extreme cruelty because they might think they were doing it in self-defense. But if you took them out of that situation and asked them as an impartial observer, they would say that was cruel. So I think most people are capable of it, absolutely.
So what exactly can we do about that?
Well, what we can do is learn what situations to look for as the danger signals, what to avoid. We can boost, for example, our reluctance to go to war, because the war is one of the biggest single determinants of this kind of cruelty. And there are a whole lot of reasons why that is, but part of it is that war brings its own set of justifications. So one of the things we can do is start to make those justifications less acceptable. Get rid of all the, you know, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori rubbish. Get rid of all this stuff. Get rid of the idea that a war can be just and justified on the kinds of shaky grounds that recent wars have been justified. So we can do all of that. We can boost, for example, ideas about human life being important, whatever it is. We can challenge negative stereotypes where we see them. We can look out for the kind of language of disgust, that kind of otherizing language, and we can challenge that when we see it. So, for example, in Britain today, it's not socially, politically acceptable to use blatant language of disgust in the way that it would have been, say, 60, 70 years ago. So if somebody were to stand up, a political leader were to stand up in Britain and say, these people are a cancer and they must be wiped out, you just couldn't do that. I mean, you would just get absolutely destroyed in the media if you did that. What you get then, of course, is the recourse to more subtle language. But nonetheless, that kind of extreme disgust language is now less acceptable than it was. And so by challenging that, by querying that, by standing up to the stereotypes, you can start to to reduce the levels of cruelty. You can also, as I say, avoid the situations that we know give rise to it. So, for example, in the American War on Terror, and every social psychologist, I'm sure, who looks at this kind of field, predicted Abu Ghraib. Not in detail, but we knew something like that was going to happen. Why? Because it always happens. And all this rubbish about it being just a few bad apples, nonsense. The situation demanded that kind of response from people, and people gave it. So if you put people into a situation where they are under severe threat, and they are also given a lot of power over people that they have been taught to demonize and otherize to an extreme extent, and then you wonder why you're going to get extreme cruelty coming out. Well, I mean, for heaven's sake, it's not a surprise. So there is all this information out there. There is a lot of knowledge already about what gives rise to cruelty. And so I think if we know, for example, that every war we fight, our soldiers are going to commit atrocities, it might make us think a little bit more about starting that war, sending people off. It might make us give our soldiers better training. It might make us cut down the level of otherization that we use in the run-up to war. So all of those things can be shifted and changed and modified just to try and actually cut down the justifications which give rise to cruelty.
So are we all responsible then?
Well, I think we are a little bit, each of us. I mean, obviously, there's only so much that any one person can do. But we're particularly responsible, for example, in standing up, speaking out, not being afraid to challenge the group. So there's that kind of level of responsibility. But obviously, political leaders and religious leaders, that kind of elevated status, celebrities even, they have more responsibility because they have much more social power than your average citizen. So, yes, we're all responsible, but we're not all equally responsible.
Kathleen, that was very thought-provoking and still extremely depressing.
I'm sorry. It's a depressing topic. It really is one of the hardest ones.
Honestly, I thank you for researching this for 4 years. It's a fantastic book, but very hard to read.
Well, thank you for reading it, and thank you for having me.
You can find Kathleen at taylorsciencewriter.com, and from there you can find links to her blog and to her books. And again, really fantastic books, just don't read it all at once. And you can find out more about us at skepticallyspeaking.com. Follow the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. On Skeptically Speaking, we do interviews with experts on everything from vitamins to paranormal research to evolution to nuclear power. But we also do interviews with people like you. Maybe you've done some research into a specific alternative health treatment and you want to share what you've learned. Or you've written a blog post on some questionable story that's been in the news and you think that people should know about it. Or you've found a creative way to talk to your children about science and you think that it could work for other parents. Or there's a skeptical project that you've been working on and it's time for some promotion. Perhaps you've had an experience where critical thinking saved your bacon and you think that the story might be valuable to other people. These are all great topics for speaking up. You bring the idea, and we'll work with you to make sure that your piece is radio ready. Just send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, give us a bit of information about your topic, and we'll contact you. All of us here at Skeptically Speaking are committed to spreading the wonders of science and critical thought. We want to encourage your efforts, and in turn, your segment encourages others. Because we all need some support. And a gentle nudge now and then to keep questioning everything.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, home.